Hello, I'm Stephen M. Sterkowski. I'm the founding chair of the new Department of Psychiatry at the new Dell Medical School at the University of Texas in Austin. Today I wanted to talk about depression and really follow up on some implied discussion in a previous recording that we had a number of months ago. So depression, major depression, is among humanity's most common ailments. It may be the most common major medical problem, in fact, once we eliminate viruses and so forth. About 7% of people are affected with depression annually, and there is somewhere around a 17% lifetime risk to perhaps as high as 1 in every 5 people. So most people have either dealt with it themselves or have family members or friends who struggled with depression. There's a number of studies that don't always agree, but in some it looks like depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide, and if not the leading, certainly one of the top 2 or 3. It's higher rates in women, although there's some debate about that. It may be that it's just missed more often in men. And then it seems to be increased in poverty and people living in stressful environments. The cause of depression is unknown, and it's so common that it almost has to be a heterogeneous condition. And so that means that there's a bunch of likely etiologies. Because of that, our research group published in a paper in 2013 a consideration of whether depression should really be thought of more as a non-specific response to brain injury rather than a specific condition per se. This is a little bit of a controversial discussion, but I thought it would be interesting to talk about it today, and I look forward to receiving comments from those of you who listen to these broadcasts. So major depression symptoms are fairly well known. They include depressed mood and anhedonia, the latter, anhedonia being probably the more specific and diagnostic symptom. Changes in sleep and appetite, changes in psychomotor behavior, either agitation or retardation, fatigue, feelings of worthlessness or excessive guilt, impaired concentration, and suicidal thinking. Many of these, for example, the low mood or anhedonia, are very, very common in the general population, perhaps as high as 30% or more, and aren't always or even typically associated with the depressive syndrome. In fact, these symptoms can be reliably diagnosed reasonably well. So in the DSM-5 field trial, the Kappa, or measure of reliability, or say 0.8 or higher is very good and 0.1 or 2 is very weak, tended to be about 0.6. So people were able to recognize these symptoms in a person when two separate raters did it on two separate occasions. However, the syndrome reliability of depression itself, when you accumulate the symptoms we just talked about, where you have at least 5 and at least 1 is depressed mood or anhedonia, then the reliability was poor, and it ranged across sites from as low as a Kappa of 0.13, which is poor, to a high of a Kappa of 0.42, suggesting that we're not always good at recognizing this condition, again, perhaps as partly a representation that is somewhat nonspecific. The ICD-10 field trial was not particularly better. Again, different types of depression were reliable differently, but ranged as low as 0.09, which is very low and very poor, to a 0.44, so virtually the same range as DSM-5. So from a syndrome and symptom constellation construct, even though the symptoms are recognizable, the syndrome has some problems in recognizing it among different clinicians, which contributes, I think, to some of the confusion around treating it. A second common problem with depression is it's perhaps the most comorbid condition in all of medicine. So if you look at the table I attached in the first slide, it becomes the most common comorbidity in psychiatry. So bipolar 1 disorder, which people often think of depression as part of it, in fact, bipolar 1 disorder, as we've discussed in other broadcasts, is defined by the occurrence of mania, and yet 90% of people will experience depression. I've posited that perhaps the depression is simply a nonspecific response to the underlying neuropathology that causes mania, which is a much more predictive and specific syndrome. It's also much more reliably diagnosed. In generalizing anxiety disorder, depression occurs in almost 70% of people. Over half of people with panic disorder or schizophrenia develop depression. Over 40% plus with alcohol and drug abuse and so forth. As you can see, depression is much, much more common in the presence of another psychiatric condition than it is in the general population. Again, suggesting that the underlying pathology causing the other psychiatric condition may be putting people at risk for depression, so that it's representing a nonspecific response to another brain pathology. Similarly, in other types of medicine, as you can see in the next slide that I've posted, depression is very, very common. I actually believe that any condition that affects the brain increases the likelihood of depression. And that includes medication and medication side effects. Any medication that's crossing the blood-brain barrier appears to increase the risk of major depression. And that's often a risk that isn't considered when prescribing medications. And so if your blood pressure medication is causing depression, that risk may be higher than, in fact, managing mild hypertension, and those considerations need to be thought about. But again, in Alzheimer's disease and multiple sclerosis, migraine, the rates of depression tend to be as high as 50%. In stroke, it ranges, you know, as low as 30%, depending where the stroke is, but in particularly prefrontal injuries, the rates of depression are very, very high following a stroke. And so even cardiovascular disease or renal disease or cancer or diabetes, which aren't thought to directly affect the brain, all have increased rates of depression. And the mechanism here may be through inflammatory processes or other nonspecific general responses to illness, but again, supporting the notion that depression can often be a nonspecific brain response to another underlying medical pathology. Additionally, major depression, it turns out, is one of our least heritable psychiatric conditions. Most of the major conditions we diagnose, for example, bipolar disorder has a heritability of about 85%. Alcohol abuse, which is thought of as being strictly under behavioral control, in fact has a genetic risk factor over 60%. And in contrast, major depression has a risk of somewhere between 31 to 40%. Now, this risk increases in people who have very well characterized recurrent major depressive illness that may, in fact, fit somewhat under the kind of classic construct of manic depressive illness, in which there's recurrent affective illnesses that just don't include mania. And so in those patients, the genetic liability approaches 70%. But the general sort of run-of-the-mill depressive patient has a family history risk of only about 30 to 40%. This suggests, again, that there are many, many more environmental factors impacting the expression of depression than other major psychiatric conditions. In fact, again, back to bipolar disorder, 71% of the genetic liability for mania is independent from the risk for depression, again, suggesting depression may be a secondary piece of bipolar 1 illness. Finally, in the families of people with other primary psychiatric conditions, there are higher rates of depression. So bipolar disorder, OCD, Parkinson's, migraine, PTSD, personality disorder families have higher rates of depression, often higher than the rates of the primary genetic illness. And so, again, it's suggesting that various types of brain pathology or even inherited risks for brain pathology increase the risk of a nonspecific depressive response. Major depression, as you know, is responsive to a number of nonspecific treatments. The SSRIs are relatively specific, but any given patient, we don't know if they're going to respond to an SSRI or an SNRI or bupropion, which has a different mechanism. And in fact, the most effective antidepressant we have, ECT, is among the least specific treatments we have. And so it suggests, again, that different types of depression perhaps are responding to different types of interventions, and unfortunately at this point we're not good at identifying which is going to be the most likely to be effective. A number of new treatments such as ketamine offer a brand new window into how we might manage depression. And so it's opening up this idea that this is a heterogeneous and often nonspecific construct within the setting of other neuropathology. In fact, the placebo response in depression tends to be very high, which is part of the struggle there's been in identifying good and specific antidepressant therapies. The psychotherapies that work in depression are also quite variable. The evidence-based ones like cognitive behavioral therapy or certain types of interpersonal therapies work by very different mechanisms, again, and don't work the same way in everyone. And so the nonspecificity and heterogeneity of the condition likely also impacts the selection of psychotherapies. And so there are many proposed mechanisms for what's underlying depression. Monoamine hypotheses, GABA hypotheses, inflammatory hypotheses, HPA axis hypotheses, related the latter specifically to the association with stress, all of which may be correct in that they all may be components of this heterogeneous nonspecific response to a variety of underlying brain pathologies. And so with that in mind, then, we have an interesting construct in the way we started thinking about this is to really spend a little more time thinking about the underlying potential cause of depression, recognizing that we often aren't really going to know it. So if there's a major stress component, for example, simply providing medications without relieving the stress is likely to be ineffective. If there's an underlying primary condition like bipolar disorder or OCD or alcohol abuse, failing to recognize and treat the primary condition is going to likely make it much more difficult to manage the depression. And in fact, managing the underlying condition may be what's necessary and may be all that's necessary in managing the depression. And so what this requires of us is to be thoughtful and careful when we're assessing depression to really look for potential associations with other conditions. As I mentioned earlier, to be thoughtful, do we really need to add this statin or antihypertensive or other drug that crosses the blood-brain barrier and increases risk of depression? Or if someone's on it and is depressed, should we think about stopping it? And so very thoughtful, systematic treatment trials, recognizing what are potential contributors to this possibly nonspecific response, and remembering medication side effects, I think it's probably the most effective intervention. And then we're going to do trial and error of what's the best medication, what's the best psychotherapy to manage this particular constellation of primary and secondary conditions. Within all that, I actually do believe there is a genetic depressive condition that's likely this recurrent illness that we just haven't completely defined yet, and so we're not able to separate it from the more general heterogeneous collection of depressive syndromes. As genetics and imaging and other technologies progress, that's likely to change. So would look forward to hearing your comments and thoughts about this. If you'd like to read more about our thoughts about this topic, we published a paper, Strakowski, myself with Drs. Caleb Adler and Melissa DiBello, in Current Psychiatry Reports in 2013, volume 15, I believe it was. And so if you look that up, you'll find this discussion, and I hope that we can continue to think about it collaboratively and cleverly to help manage people and improve their lives as much as possible. Thank you for watching today. I appreciate it.